From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point. ISIS claimed responsibility for a terror attack in Brussels Tuesday that killed more than 30 and injured more than 100. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel responded to the attacks.
We are facing a difficult, challenging time, and we should face up to this challenge by being united.
President Obama made a historic trip to Cuba. It's the first time a sitting U.S. president has visited the island in 88 years.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
Things heated up between Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Donald Trump when their wives got involved in campaign attacks. Here's Cruz.
Donald, you're a sniveling coward, and leave Heidi the hell alone.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley of Politico, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? How are you responding to the attacks in Brussels? What do you make of the response from our own presidential candidates? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Ray.
Also in Washington, Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Hi, Ray. Pleasure to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Ray, Karen, and Michael.
Well, let's start in Europe. French President François Hollande spoke on Tuesday about the terror attacks in Brussels and expressed solidarity with the Belgian people. Here he is interpreted by Reuters.
Terrorism has hit Belgium, but Europe was targeted, and the whole world is concerned.
Et c'est tout le monde.
Speaking at a news conference with Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. is grieving for those killed and injured in the attacks, including American residents.
The United States, I want you to know, is praying and grieving with you for the loved ones of those who have been very cruelly taken from us, including Americans, and for the many who were injured in these despicable attacks.
Republican Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz drew criticism this week for a statement he issued after the terror attacks in Brussels Tuesday. Cruz wrote, "We need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized." He defended his statement on CNN later in the day.
Our enemies are not every Muslims. Our enemy is radical Islamic terrorists, are the jihadists that seek to murder us. And it is the heart of law enforcement and national security to prevent those who are waging war on you from actually carrying out their attempted acts of war.
Michael Crowley, was that a revealing moment for you?
Well, I suppose. I mean, we've known for some time where Ted Cruz is coming from on these issues. So I think it was illustrative, but look, Ted Cruz announced a team of foreign policy advisors now, I think, about 10 days ago, so before the Brussels attacks. And I wrote a story about these advisors of his, and there was a little bit of diversity of views among them. But I would say what really unified these people he selected and presented as the team that is counseling him on these issues is that, you know, they really come from a part of the Republican Party that is obsessed with Islamic extremism, particularly in the United States, this idea that Islamic Sharia law is creeping its way into American society and government, poses a threat to the Constitution. One of the advisors he tapped was a man named Frank Gaffney, a former Reagan administration official, who has accused President Obama of being a Muslim and at one point even repeated a claim that a government logo, a Pentagon agency logo, seemed to combine an Islamic symbol with the Obama campaign logo. I mean, pretty fringe stuff. So I guess to answer your question, I think we knew already that Ted Cruz is sort of drawing his thinking from the kind of far extremes of conservative thought on these issues, which is very punitive and militant toward the Muslim threat in ways that I think diverge with what to me is the consensus view of how you deal with these issues in the counterterrorism community.
Karen Tumulty, I suspect it's not just now during a national political season, but long since that we could expect a unified American response to a tragedy overseas.
Yeah, that's it has been quite a while, I guess, since then. And I think that, you know, looking at Ted Cruz's response, this one cynical way of looking at it, and to paraphrase Lily Tomlin, you know, in politics, no matter how cynical you get, you can't keep up, is that, you know, Ted Cruz has also to have had in mind the fact that, you know, after the Paris bombings, when Donald Trump proposed a temporary ban on Muslims entering this country, his poll numbers just shot through the roof. You know, this is something that when a lot of pundits first heard it, they thought, oh, you know, this is something that's going to really, you know, sort of create a backlash. And the opposite happened. So, you know, this time it was Ted Cruz who you know, wanted to jump in right after and come in with the toughest sounding language.
You know, sometimes, Jack, it's dismissed as sort of elite opinion versus popular opinion. But if you look at the 1%, and that's all it is, the 1% of the U.S. population that is Muslim, they don't live the way they live in Paris, in banlieues, in big Turkish neighborhoods, in Berlin, other major German cities. This is a very well assimilated population in many circumstances. And as I watched Ted Cruz, I wondered, does he know? Does he not know? Or let's say he knows, does he even care? I wasn't sure. Like, how do you patrol Muslim neighborhoods when, for the most part, we don't have Muslim neighborhoods?
Oh, yes. I mean, talk about cynicism. You know, the politics of fear is just dangerous to democracy. And his statement, I think, indicated that. And this comes at a moment when abroad, big front page piece in The Washington Post today by Liz Sly, ISIS is being contracted. It's losing ground. Lost 40% of its territory in the last 3 years. It's being squeezed by the Syrian government in Palmyra. There's about to be an attack on Mosul some weeks hence in Iraq. Its leaders are being assassinated by American drones and other vehicles of death. And so that's happening there. And meanwhile, what about domestic terrorism? What about the threat to Americans from this, you know, this radical Islamic terror? Well, according to Graham Allison, writing in the Boston Globe, a person living in the United States is 100 times more likely to be killed by a falling object than by a jihadi terrorist. And your chance of being killed by lightning, 8 times the chance of dying from a jihadi terrorist attack, or being murdered with a firearm, 2,900 times. But meanwhile, you turn on the television on Tuesday, wall to wall, hour after hour on the cable channels, fear, fear, fear. I mean, we had experts on fear. We had psychologists on fear. We had people who are fear entrepreneurs selling fear. And what was lost in this is perspective. So you say, how is it that someone like Cruz can say something like that? Because you've got a whole industry that is making the American public afraid of what really, to us today, is a kind of phantom threat.
Let's go out to the rest of the country, see what people are thinking for this week in review. Muhammad joins us now from Lincoln, Nebraska. Welcome to On Point, Muhammad.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me. My point is, before we are looking for the reasons that leads for all this terrorism action in the whole world, we need to focus about the reasons behind them. Who is funding them? Who is providing the structure for them, who is provide the fatwa, who is provide their media in the Middle East? The answer is simply is Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabism. All that we are suffering in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and all over the world. The danger is not just in Middle East. The danger is now in everywhere. And ISIS start to be expanded, start to be hit the world everywhere. I can't imagine they are here in Nebraska. They are everywhere in the United States. There is no any doubt they will be everywhere. They are separate, just like cancer. They need to be treated well. They are just like a cancer, as I said, need to be terminated from our world. We are, as a Muslim, totally condemning any kind of violence against anyone, not just against the Muslims. And we need to focus well about how to eliminate them from our society.
You know, Mohammed, just in the past few minutes, the news broke that a man considered to be the Islamic State's second in command has been killed by U.S. coalition forces. This is coming from multiple news agency reports. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter and the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Joseph Dunford are scheduled to hold a news conference coming up in just a short while. Michael Crowley, Karen Tumulty, and Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Are you happy with the results of Tuesday's primaries and caucuses? How do you read Obama's trip to Cuba? Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty are all with me from our website. Agnestes writes, I was wondering earlier about what your chances are in the U.S. of being killed by a collapsing highway bridge or other public infrastructure, echoing you, Jack, from earlier, as opposed to by a terrorist action. Pretty high, I'll bet, but battling infrastructure collapse isn't sexy, like bloviating about how big and brave you are in the face of enemies you've never been within 5,000 miles of. And of course, you'd need the real bravery required to tell your constituents the taxes have to go up to pay for it. John Boston writes, split-screen images of Obama cozying up to a mass murderer like Castro at a ball game, while the other half-screen is focused on the carnage in Brussels, is all you need to know about this president. His true legacy will be his complete abdication as president and total failure of leadership. Carl is with us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome.
Thank you very much. I tell you, the trip and the reopening of relations with Cuba is phenomenal. It's well overdue. If you stop and think about it, we have relations with Vietnam. We have relations with China. We have relations with Russia. Good God, we have relations with Germany. We went to two world wars against those guys. So when I hear people say, well, they shouldn't open relations at normal because of what Cuba do to their people. Look at Russia. I mean, look at China. Their human rights are appalling, but we have normal relations. And a side note, it's very disturbing this week when I kept hearing Republicans and some journalists questioning President Obama whether he should have stayed in Cuba or kept his South America trip going in the face of terrorism. And it's disturbing to me as a black American because I don't remember them ever doing wall-to-wall coverage of an African nation whenever they have a terrorist attack. I don't recall them, you know, standing in unity with any nation of color. And it happens all the time. These attacks happen all the time to African nations and Arab nations on a daily basis where 20, 30, 40 people are being killed in a hotel somewhere. But as soon as it happens to Europe, it's wall-to-wall coverage.
Actually, Carl, just a matter of days before the attack in Brussels, there was one in the Ivory Coast that took a large number of lives. Karen Tumulty, your thoughts on the Cuba trip in light of what Carl said and what John Boston wrote on our website?
Well, I think the Cuba trip was also a major legacy item for President Obama, as he had said in the clip that you played at the beginning of this broadcast. It was, you know, it was sort of the last vestige of the Cold War in, you know, in our part of the world. And so it was very important for him. I think that public opinion is highly, you know, largely with him on this. And, you know, the criticism, too, that he's, you know, you heard from some pundits that he should have just sort of gotten up and skedaddled back to the White House. Also, you know, it's this suggestion that somehow you can't sort of leave the White House if you're the president and still keep your finger on what's going on. I think there the Brussels attacks certainly did raise a lot of questions about coordination and how well countries share information about people who could be dangerous. And I think that that really is one of the things, you know, apprehending these people and figuring out how to prevent this from happening again is probably of more concern to more people.
Interestingly, Michael Crowley, Carl's sort of second line when he's talking about dropping everything and having to suspend the trip, it reminds you of the sort of Eurocentric focus in a lot of ways of the American public, even now, all these years later, with a much more diverse population. Argentina is a major South American nation that has had major economic and political problems in recent decades, just elected a new president that is trying to get his arms around the economic problems there and trying to reverse, from his point of view, many years of Peronism. That's an important date to keep, too, isn't it? I mean, along with being in solidarity with the Europeans and being concerned about Brussels, it's not like you can just sort of flip off the Argentines either.
Right. And I think this well, one quick point is that I think in particular, although America has become much more diverse, I think media elites, and I suppose I'm an example of that, are almost certainly not as diverse as the country at large. And you could do a whole show on that. But to your question about the president's travel, you know, I think the president actually quite firmly believes that it's very important that he not hop on a plane every time there's a terrorist bombing. First of all, he would never be able to go anywhere. Second of all, he is trying to promote a philosophy of resilience, of, you know, to use the kind of cliche, not letting the terrorists win. They want everybody to drop everything. They want wall-to-wall media coverage, and, you know, goodness knows that they get that. But they want everybody to drop everything else they're doing and think about nothing but the killing that they've executed and their demented ideology and to cower in fear of them. And finally, I think President Obama feels strongly that, and this has been a clear theme throughout his presidency, indeed through his candidacy in 2008 when he campaigned fundamentally on extricating America from Iraq, that we spend too much time focused on the Middle East. It's nothing but trouble. We need it less than we used to because of changes in energy markets, and that it's essential in part because of this increasing diversity and sort of flatness of the world that America kind of have a stronger game in places like Latin America and Asia. None of this is to suggest that the president doesn't take terrorism seriously or ISIS seriously or the Middle East seriously, but I think he's trying to almost defiantly show a sense of balance and proportion and also say, I'm not going to let you guys dictate my schedule. But it's tricky. You see the political cost that he pays on TV talk shows and in a large segment of the American public, but he seems pretty determined to stick with it.
Jack Beatty, away from the microphones, as a private citizen, I'm always tempted to say optics schmoptics. But at the same time, there are pictures of the president and Michelle Obama at a ball game, pictures of the president tango dancing in Buenos Aires. Is it a problem when this becomes what we talk about during a week when they were picking up body parts in an air terminal in Belgium?
I think it's only a problem if you have a will to find it as such, and his political opponents do. John Boston was talking about cozying up to the murderer, Castro, at the ball game. Well, you know, to change Cuba, President Obama really is following FDR's advice. FDR said the way to end communism in Soviet Russia, distribute the Sears Roebuck catalog to every Russian. You know, Adam Smith called the what Adam Smith called the desire of every man to better his condition. That will melt the Cuban autocracy into air. Not today, not tomorrow, but irresistibly. Call it change you can believe in. The president is betting on the American, on what really is exceptional about America: abundance, the market, choices, economic freedom. Just the reverse of cozying up to a dictator. The dictator may not realize it, but he's allowing the forces that are going to undo his regime eventually into his country.
Not getting enough attention is the fact that Obama actually got to talk on nationwide TV in Cuba and at a news conference where he put it directly to the Cuban president that this is a country that needed change. He spoke on Tuesday and encouraged the Cuban government to welcome different voices and opinions of the Cuban people.
To President Castro, who I appreciate being here today, I want you to know I believe my visit here demonstrates you do not need to fear a threat from the United States. And given your commitment to Cuba's sovereignty and self-determination, I am also confident that you need not fear the different voices of the Cuban people and their capacity to speak and assemble and vote for their leaders.
Karen Tumulty.
We're back to what this trip was a legacy item for the president. But the fact is that, getting back to one of your earlier points, no matter what a president does, our politics have so invaded everything, partisanship has, that he's going to get criticized. But it's not just a one-way street. Don't forget, too, how President George W. Bush was criticized for playing golf while people were dying in Iraq by the left. So, again, it has just reached the point where I think a president has to just sort of put his head down and do what he thinks are his priorities and do what he thinks is going to add to his place in history, and decide that, you know, he's not going to listen to that.
Carrie is with us now from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to comment and say that in order to really progress our relations with Cuba, we need to do exactly what Obama has implemented in the past week. I think that to perpetuate this Cold War phenomena that we need to be rivals against people who just don't share ideologies is not only backwards, but we can't spread our own ideology of democracy and equal and human rights against people who, such as Castro, who believe that communism is the way to go. I just don't understand how people can think that going backwards and staying stuck in this ideal where we need to totally isolate people who don't share our democratic beliefs. So,
well, Carrie, let me ask you something. A lot of the critics of the trip have said the president, the American administration, didn't ask for enough in return for the tremendous benefit of being recognized by the United States, getting this outreach, this interest from American investors, that on the return side, Cuba has had to do little or nothing.
I think that's underestimating the step that the administration has taken. Just by reaching out and physically going to Cuba in itself is a huge step forward. So I think that this is going to be a slow process, and I think that gradualism is the way to go in this respect, just because we've isolated Cuba from ourselves for so many decades that to go in and just headstrong would just be folly, because I don't think it could work out that well.
Carrie, thanks for your call. Jay joins us now from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Jay, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
What's on your mind, Jay?
Okay, what's on my mind is the fact that people don't know enough about what's going on 90 miles off the shore of America. There's a huge racial situation there where the Castros and their oligarchy that run the country control all the resources. If you notice, most of the resources are owned by people who are whiter than the general population. Approximately half of Cuba, by American standards or more, black people, are African Americans, because that's the Americas, you know, traditionally speaking. And the issue is, will the Castro step down? what Obama did was made a visit, basically telling them that they have to do it peacefully because there's a situation there that anyone that's been keeping track knows of. Black people there can't even visit their relatives who stay in hotels. There's segregation. Black people who are doctors only make $20 a month, so they quit being doctors, and they end up working in the tourist industry. This is a situation here that Americans don't know about.
Yeah, there is, Jay, I think, an unseen racial dimension to the stratification of Cuban society, that because we're so captivated by communism and the post-Cold War tale of U.S.-Cuban relations, we don't see, for instance, the difference that it can make in your life to have access to hard currency if you're a regular rank-and-file Cuban. And the Cubans who have the most access are those with relatives in the United States, and they tend to be whiter than the Cuban population overall. We tend to look at this in political terms rather than racial terms, but I'm sure in Cuba, Michael Crowley, it does not escape notice that the United States' first black president is the one who has broken this stalemate and come down for a visit.
Well, certainly not. And that point was not lost on President Obama himself, who made a point of talking about racism in Cuba on his trip and reminding his audience there of the uniqueness of his own presidency and the historical meaning of his own background. And then saying that he hoped that part of the engagement with Cuba would, I think his language was, to lift up Cubans of African descent and help them achieve their potential. So it was fairly mild. He wasn't denouncing the Cuban government on this front, but it was a something that he clearly wanted to draw attention to, clearly something he's focused on.
A little bit lost in the sauce this week is the story coming out of another part of Cuba that the president didn't visit, Guantanamo. Paul Lewis is a Defense Department special envoy for Guantanamo detention closure. On Wednesday, he spoke at a hearing in Washington about President Obama's plan to close Guantanamo and relocate prisoners to the United States. Here, he responded to a question from Representative Dana Rohrabacher, Republican of California, who asked him how many people had died because of released detainees.
Unfortunately, there have been Americans that have died because of Gitmo detainees.
How many Americans have to die? How many people in Brussels or Paris have to die, civilians? What's the threshold at that point? Well, maybe we will keep them under control in Gitmo.
Sir, when anybody dies, it's a tragedy, and we don't want anybody to die because we transfer detainees.
Let's take a quick look, Karen Tumulty, just for a half a minute or so before the break, and then we'll continue on the other side of the break. This is a huge issue in Cuba and, of course, always in the United States.
That's right. And, you know, I think most people are probably pretty skeptical that President Obama is going to be able to succeed in this plan. And again, another legacy item. It's something that he promised he would do as he was running for president. But on the other side, you have, you have a Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump, who's saying he would actually, you know, stiffen and increase use of things like waterboarding.
And send more people to Guantanamo instead of emptying the place out. Michael Crowley, Karen Tumulty, and Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week on The Tonight Show Wednesday, Jimmy Fallon joked about the 2016 presidential race.
There's a website called VoteTrumpGetDumped.com. That's asking women not to sleep with Trump supporters. Or as Melania put it, what is name of site again? What?
Comedian Gary Shandling died yesterday at 66. On HBO's The Larry Sanders Show, he played a fictional late-night talk show, Larry. Here he talked off-camera with guest Robin Williams.
How am I really doing?
Huh? What? You did great, really? Man. What are you doing? Yeah, come on, you're Robin Williams, for God's sakes. Are you unaware of that?
No.
And rapper Malik Taylor, better known as Fife Dog, one of the founding members of a tribe called Quest, died Tuesday. He rapped in Can I Kick It, first recorded in 1989 when he was 19.
Can I kick it? Can I kick it?
I'm kicking it with Michael Crowley of Politico, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Well, let me tell you what people are writing in and making some very smart comments, some interesting, provocative things to point out. J plus J writes, Islamophobia is nothing more than veiled racism by ignorant people, plain and simple. John writes, there is no need to overstate the threat, but to dismiss it as a phantom threat is foolish. The most newsworthy thing about the primaries this week, writes Guant, is that people in Arizona were waiting in line 4 hours and no one cares. I've covered some of the first elections in developing and democratizing countries where we celebrate and extol and praise people who wait hour after hour in endless lines to vote. You just don't think you're going to see it in the United States, Jack Beatty.
No, Maricopa County, people were waiting 5-6 hours. You know, Arizona was one of the states covered by the Voting Rights Act. They were mostly southern states, but there were some others. Arizona was one of them. And under that, the old Voting Rights Act, any change in its election procedures had to be run by the Justice Department. They had to get clearance for something like this. Well, thanks to John Roberts and the Supreme Court, they don't have to do that anymore. So the county commissioner made a decision to take, I think, something like 250 polling places and crunch them into 60. The ratio was something like that. And the result was this catastrophe. She was interviewed about it, and she said, well, what do you, you know, what's your thought? And she said, well, you know, people should have voted early. They should have voted by mail. She was doing everything. And finally, she did take responsibility. The point is, before the John Roberts Court pronounced, that idea would have been run by the Justice Department. And given Arizona's history, it would not likely have passed.
Karen Tumulty, is that a lesson we're going to have to learn by doing? What it means to vacate some of the sections of the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, and it's coming against a backdrop here where, you know, turnout, and at least on the Republican side of these primaries, has been huge. And so it's, you know, it's sort of ironic because these are largely, you know, in many places, Republican officials who are limiting access on, you know, on election day to voting places, even as their party seems to be, you know, surging to the polls.
Let's go to Brandon. He's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray.
What's up, Brandon?
So on the subject of just, there's a lot going on in the news, a lot of fear, a lot of racism, Islamophobia, hatred. And one of the things I wanted to express my greatest concern, I'm going to be 25 years old soon. I'm in nursing school. I'm terrified of just the citizens of my own country here in the United States. It's hearing Trump on the media, hearing Cruz, hearing them talk about how they're going to build a wall and Mexico's paying for it. Mexico says, no, we're not. They want to put a temporary ban on Muslims, which is completely unheard of and racist and something I never anticipated since my early years. Hearing something coming from that, from someone who's leading in the polls to represent the Republican Party. And what's really irks me and scares me is I hope that it's something to do with them being ignorant or uneducated, but it's the people voting for people like Trump and Cruz, people who are spreading those messages of hate and not cooperation. And I only like to think that those people voting, those millions of people, who are supporting Trump and causing these violence at rallies, that they must be uneducated or ignorant, because it would only be that much scarier if these people are highly educated and making rational decisions when thinking, yes, I think this is the best person to represent this nation and to try to form ties and cooperations with the world. You see all people who are voting for Trump also criticizing Obama meeting in Cuba, trying to create cooperation there, is something that I wouldn't expect the conservatives to really reach out to. And it's, I think people forget it's not as much those people that are running for president like Trump and Cruz that are scary. It's the people that are supporting them, the people that are backing them and going to the polls and the primaries and voting for them.
Brandon, lest you think you're the only one who's scared, Michael Crowley, there's a lot going on in Republican circles, sort of openly speculating about what they would do to derail their own party's front runner, top vote getter, top delegate winner.
Well, it's unprecedented. It's a totally astounding thing to watch. And, you know, there's a little bit of a divide. I think there's some people in the party who feel like this is a runaway train that you can't stop. If you try to get in front of it, you're going to get plowed over. Maybe you can try to jump on the train and harness it, control it, slow it down, guide Trump into a direction that's more responsible and in line with the party principles. I don't think anyone's ever had much luck in telling Trump what to do. But, you know, on the question of his supporters, I would say this is something I wrote about this week. It's a very interesting question in the context of what we saw in Brussels and this drumbeat of terror attacks and terror fears. You know, how fundamental is this to the rise of Donald Trump? Trump is a very from-the-gut, emotional, kind of brute force response candidate. And at a time when voters are very afraid, maybe too afraid, we've talked about this. We've talked about the role of the media. We've talked about proportionality. But the reality is people are very afraid. Are they responding in that kind of gut-level, emotional way to a candidate like Trump that, particularly if we see more attacks, and God forbid attacks in the United States, could really pave his way to the White House? Hillary Clinton this week gave a speech trying to put her own spin on things, and it was much more temperate, you know, stay calm, I have a plan, diplomacy, intelligence sharing, our NATO allies. And I think a big question is, are voters going to be in a mood for that kind of nuanced, you know, calm and steady response versus a guy who's basically offering a clenched fist response and playing to their guts? And, you know, I think it's a very open question. Certainly in the primary, that style seems to be helping Trump.
Nick is with us now from Burlington. Oh, well, hold on, Nick. Well, hold that thought for a moment. Karen Tumulty is here. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, though, I spend a lot of time talking to Trump supporters. And, you know, it's the fact is, and this is a guy who's winning in places like Vermont and New Hampshire, in the Deep South, in Michigan, in Arizona, all over the country. And you also hear, and the sense you get is that he is speaking to something that people see happening in their own lives. In particular, you know, they see the good jobs going away. They feel like America gets pushed around in the world. And, you know, it is that Trump has sort of given a voice to what people are themselves seeing. And, you know, it's hard to tell somebody that, you know, well, we're having economic growth in this country when they've seen the factories shut down in their town and that the jobs have gone to Mexico and that, you know, all that's left for their children is, you know, fast food and the hospitality industry.
But are they asking for enough from Trump to answer what you do about those things that he's accurately seeing about their own lives?
What they have decided, I think, is that government and Washington particular has – it's responding to other people's concerns, that it's rigged against them. And I think at this point they have so given up any hope on Washington ever functioning that, you know, they think, you know, it wouldn't be such a bad thing to drop a bomb on it. And in this case, the bomb is named Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Burlington, Vermont is next. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Yeah, so I'm appreciate that this conversation is going to the primaries, but I really don't see a Republican president coming into office this year. It's just that they need to get you know, a lot more inclusive, and they're really pushing people away. I think the conversation should be focused more on the Democratic side of the primary. And in particular, I feel like there's a real imbalanced reporting having to do with Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders. You know, this week during the primaries going on Tuesday, Bernie was in Arizona, and there were tens of thousands of people showed up at his rally to hear him speak. And instead, the major news networks were broadcasting an empty Trump stage, just waiting for him to talk. And it just seems that we're so obsessed with the idea that, you know, this entertainer, this man, Donald Trump, is, you know, he has a real chance at becoming president. And we're not paying attention to the excitement and the, you know, and the inclusion that's being generated by Bernie's campaign. And I find that most news networks, including NPR, are really kind of dismissing him, making it seem like he's, you know, it's already Hillary's game. And that's not the case with how voters feel.
Well, Nick, if some smart graduate student wants to quantify your concerns, I think they would find a difference between the broadcast news organizations and the print news organizations. It so happens I have two fine print reporters with me who have been out on the trail. And why don't you respond to Nick's concerns? First, Michael.
Well, certainly you can't dismiss those concerns. And I would say, you know, even people at the TV networks, I think, sheepishly admit that they've gone overboard on Trump. And, you know, again, this is another longer conversation, but the TV networks are not performing a public service.
Are they underplaying Sanders, though?
Well, look, I think there was a period of time when you could argue they were overplaying Sanders early in the process, or at least tonally, really hard on Hillary Clinton and almost kind of cheerleading what seemed like her potential demise over these emails. And when things were close, Sanders got quite a lot of coverage. The reality is now Hillary Clinton is winning votes. Sanders has a very steep road to climb. Now, am I going to defend airing footage of an empty Donald Trump stage instead of a Sanders speech? No, but I think it's a harder case for a Sanders supporter to make now that Sanders has lost several times. Hillary Clinton has amassed a large delegate lead and is in a very strong position.
Karen?
I think I would agree with everything that Michael said. I think the Sanders supporters have a legitimate complaint. The problem is it's sort of there's like the Donald Trump phenomenon and everything else that's going on in this race. And it's looking more and more like Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee, which means, you know, the analysis and the scrutiny is moving back in her direction. And for both the networks, but even those of us who are, you know, in the print business is now the web business. And we can see that there's extraordinary amount of interest in anything you write about Donald Trump. We put up a transcript of our editorial board meeting with him, and it has been one of our most read, most shared things on the web this week through the attacks in Brussels, through everything else, through the president's trip to Cuba. It's just like people can't seem to get enough of this guy.
It is recommended reading. Visit the Washington Post website and take a look. It's really astounding. Jack Beatty, your thoughts?
I understand where the caller is coming from. I mean, but I think facts are stubborn things, and if you just point them out, as Michael did, as Karen did, it can sound like it's biased toward Hillary. But those are just the facts. It's the reality that's biased. And Bernie Sanders, you know, I pointed out on this show some months ago that for the first time that the NAACP has been around for, I think, 100 years. And for the first time ever, it opened an office in Vermont just last year. Well, that tells you a lot, doesn't it? It's a great state. It's also probably one of the whitest states, if not the whitest in the union. And Bernie Sanders in his career has had very little, I mean, sure, as a student at the University of Chicago, as a young man, but in his political career has not dealt with issues that are of vital concern to America's minorities. Hillary Clinton and her husband have, And that's in the bank for them. That's credit. And all along, it was clear that Bernie's was going to run into that firewall of the makeup of the Democratic Party. That has come to pass. And I would argue that he's even perhaps made things harder on himself by always changing the subject from race to class. I mean, he just can't. That's how a socialist sees things. I understand that. But to minorities, that doesn't sound, in an age when we have the, you know, abuses of human rights and police and so on, that just doesn't, that hasn't rung so well.
Some final thoughts from Twitter. Davis writes, "It's about time the U.S. president turned attention to Latin America, their future markets, Democratic, and our neighbors." Kevin writes, "It's best to get in ahead to Cuba, ahead of political transition, helping to influence the new regime." Just a few moments ago came word from the Pentagon, from Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter, that the United States has killed the finance minister of the Islamic State in the region. Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, great to talk to you.
My pleasure.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, thanks again.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, Europe's patchwork of spy agencies after Brussels. I'm Ray Suarez. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.